slams me into the locker, and before I can even blink, punches me in the eye, and then again in the nose. It's all I can do to stay on my feet, and I am counting like hell now because I want to kill the son of a bitch. I wonder, if I count long enough, whether I can go back in time, all the way to the beginning of eighth grade, before I was weird and before anyone noticed me, and before I opened my mouth and talked to Romer, and before they called me freak, and I was awake all the time, and everything felt okay and somewhat normal, whatever normal is, and people actually looked at me, not to stare, not to watch for what I'd do next, but looked at me like, oh hey, what's up, man? What's up, buddy? I wonder, if I count backward, whether I can go back and take Violet Markey with me, and then move forward with her so we have more time. Because it's time I fear. And me. I'm afraid of me.
Is there a problem here?
Capel stands a couple of feet away, eyeing us. He's got a baseball bat in his hand, and I can hear him at home telling the wife,
"The trouble isn't the freshmen, it's the older ones, once they start working out and hitting those growth spurts. That's when you gotta protect yourself, no matter what."
"No problem," I tell him. "No trouble." If I know Capel like I know Capel, he's never going to take this to Principal Wirth's, not when one of his best baseball players is involved. I wait to get blamed for it. I'm all set to hear the details of my detention or expulsion, even if I'm the only one bleeding. But then Cappy says,
"We're done here, Finch. You can go."
I wipe the blood off and smile at Romer as I walk away.
"Not so fast, Romero,"
I hear Cappy bark, and the sound of Romer groveling almost makes the pain worth it. I stop at my locker to get my books, and sitting on top of them is what looks like the Hoosier Hill Rock. I pick it up, flip it over, and sure enough, "Your turn," it says. "What's that?" Brenda wants to know. She takes it out of my hand and examines it. "I don't get it. Your turn? Your turn for what?" "It's a private joke. Only the really sexy, really cool people know what it means." She punches my arm. "Then you must have no clue. What happened to your eye?"
"Your boyfriend, Romer?"
She makes a face. "I never liked him."
"Really?"
"Shut up. I hope you broke his nose."
"I'm trying to rise above."
"Wuss." She walks with me, chatting away. "Are you totally into Violet Markey, like the forever kind, or the she's interesting for right now kind? What about Suze Haynes? Didn't you used to have a thing for her? What about the three Briannas and those macrame girls? What would you do if Emma Watson fell from the sky right now? Would you even want to feel her up, or would you tell her to leave you alone? Do you think my hair would look better purple or blue? Do you think I need to lose weight? Be honest. Do you think any guy will ever have sex with me or love me for who I am?"
I answer, "Right. I don't think so. Of course. You never can tell."
And all the while, I'm thinking about Violet Markey, lockpicker.
Violet, February 2nd. Mrs. Kresny folds her hands and smiles her too broad smile. "How are you, Violet?"
"I'm fine. And you?"
"I'm fine. Let's talk about you. I want to know how you're feeling."
"I'm good, actually. Better than I've been in a long time."
"Really?"
She's surprised. "Yes. I've even started writing again, and riding in a car."
"How are you sleeping?"
Pretty well, I think.
Any bad dreams?
No.
Not even one?
Not in a while now. For the first time, it's the truth. In Russian Lit, Mrs. Mahone assigns us a 5-page paper on Turgenev's Fathers and Sons. She looks at me, and I don't mention anything about extenuating circumstances or not being ready. I copy down the notes like everyone else. Afterward, Ryan says, "Can I talk to you?" Mrs. Mahone watches as I walk on by her. I give her a wave. "What's up?" I say to Ryan. We go out into the hallway and are swept along with the sea of people. Ryan takes my hand so he doesn't lose me, and I'm like, "Oh, God." But then there's a little break in the crowd and he lets go.
"Where are you headed next?"
"Lunch." We walk together, and Ryan says,
"So, I just wanted to let you know that I asked Suze out. I thought you should hear it from me before it got all over school."
"That's great." I almost say something about Finch, but then I'm not sure what to say because I don't know what we are or if we're anything. "Thanks for telling me. I hope Suze knows what a good guy you are." He nods, gives me his signature smile. I can see the dimple, and then says,
"I don't know if you heard, but Romer went after Finch today in gym."
"What do you mean, went after?"
"Whatever. Banged him up a little. Romer's an asshole."
"What happened? Like, to them? Did they get expelled?"
"I don't think so. It was Kappel's class. And he's not going to report Romer and risk losing him for practice. I gotta go."
A few steps away, he turns.
"Finch didn't even try to defend himself. He just stood there and took it."
In the cafeteria, I walk past my regular table, past Amanda and Romer and the audience gathered there. I can hear Romer talking, but I can't hear what he's saying. I walk to the other side of the room, toward a half-empty table, but then behind me I hear my name. Brenda Schenk Kravitz is sitting with the three Briannas and a dark-haired girl named Lara at a round table by the window. "Hey," I say. "Do you mind if I join you?" I feel like I'm the new girl again, trying to make friends and figure out where I fit. Brenda picks up her backpack and sweater and keys and phone and all the other things that are spilled across the table, and dumps them onto the floor. I set my tray down and sit next to her. Lara is so small she looks like a freshman, even though I know we're in the same class. She is telling the story of how just 5 minutes ago she accidentally, without meaning to, told her crush she loved him. Instead of crawling under the table, she just laughs and keeps eating. Then the Briannas are talking about life after high school. One is a musician, one is planning to be a copy editor, and the other is practically engaged to her longtime boyfriend. She says she might run a cookie shop one day or write book reviews, but whatever she does, she's going to enjoy everything she can while she can. The boyfriend joins us, and the two of them sit side by side, looking comfortable and happy, and like they really might be together forever. I eat and listen, and at some point Brenda leans over and says in my ear, "Gabe Romero is poison." I raise my water bottle, and she raises her soda can. We tap them together and drink. Violet. The weekend. By now, the wandering is really an excuse to drive somewhere and make out. I tell myself I'm not ready, because to me sex is a big deal, even if some of my friends have been doing it since 9th grade. But the thing is, my body feels this strange, urgent tug toward Finch, like it can't get enough. I add a category to my germ board, sex life, and write a few pages in our wandering notebook, which is slowly turning into my journal slash sounding board slash
place to brainstorm material for the new webzine. Before Amanda and I stopped being peripheral semi-friends, I remember sleeping over at her house and talking to her older brothers. They told us that girls who do are sluts, and girls who don't are teases. Those of us who were there that night took this to heart, because none of the rest of us had older brothers. When we were by ourselves again, Amanda said, "The only way around it is to stay with one guy forever." But does forever have a built-in ending? Finch picks me up Saturday morning, and he looks a little battered. We don't even drive that far, just to the Arboretum, where we park the car. And before he reaches for me, I say, "What happened with Romer?"
"How'd you hear about Romer?"
"Ryan told me. And it's kind of obvious you were in a fight."
"Does it make me look hotter?"
"Be serious. What happened?"
"Nothing you need to worry about. He was being an asshole. Big surprise. Now, if we're done talking about him, I've got other things on my mind."
He climbs into the back of Little Bastard and pulls me after him. I feel like I'm living for these moments, the moments when I'm just about to lie down beside him, when I know it's getting ready to happen, his skin on mine, his mouth on mine, and then when he's touching me and the electric current is shooting through me everywhere. It's like all the other hours of the day are spent looking forward to right now. We kiss until my lips are numb, stopping ourselves at the very edge of someday, saying, "Not yet, not here," even though it takes willpower I didn't know I had. My mind is spinning with him, and with the unexpected, almost, of today. When he gets home, he writes me a message.
"I am thinking, rather consistently, of someday."
I write, "Someday soon." Finch.
"Someday when?"
Me. Question mark, question mark, question mark, question mark. Finch.
Asterisk, number sign, at sign, asterisk, exclamation point, exclamation point, exclamation point.
Me. Smiley face. 9 a.m., Sunday. My house. When I wake up and go downstairs, my parents are in the kitchen slicing bagels. My mom looks at me over the coffee mug Eleanor and I gave her one year on Mother's Day. Rock star mom. She says,
"You got a package."
"It's Sunday. Someone left it on the doorstep." I follow her into the dining room, thinking that she walks like Eleanor, hair swinging, shoulders back. Eleanor looked more like my dad, and I look more like mom. She and Mom had the same gestures, same mannerisms, so everyone always said, "Oh my God, she looks just like you." It hits me that my mother may never hear that again. There's something in brown paper, the kind you wrap fish in, sitting on the dining room table. It's tied with a red ribbon. The package itself is lumpy. Ultraviolet, it reads on one side.
"Do you know who it's from?"
My dad is in the doorway, bagel crumbs in his beard.
"James,"
my mom says, and makes little brushing motions. He rubs at his chin. I don't have any choice but to open the package in front of them, and I just hope to God it's nothing embarrassing, because from Theodore Finch, you never know. As I tug off the ribbon and rip at the paper, I'm suddenly 6 years old at Christmas. Every year, Eleanor knew what she was getting. After we picked the lock to my mom's office closet, my sister would open her gifts and mine too, but not before I left the room. Later, when she wanted to tell me what they were, I wouldn't let her. Those were the days when I didn't mind surprises. Inside the brown paper is a pair of goggles. The kind you wear swimming.
"Do you have any idea who they're from?"
Mom says. Finch.
goggles,
she says.
Sounds serious.
She gives me a hopeful little smile. Sorry, Mom. He's just a friend. I don't know why I say this, but I don't want them asking me what he means or what this is, especially when I'm not really sure myself. Maybe in time. There's always time, she replies, which is something Eleanor used to say. I look at my mom to see if she realizes she's quoted her, but if she does realize it, she doesn't show it. She is too busy examining the goggles, asking my dad if he remembers the days he used to send her things when he was trying to convince her to go out with him. Upstairs, I write, "Thanks for the goggles. What are they for? Please tell me you don't want us to use them for someday." Finch writes back,
"Wait and see. We'll use them soon. We're watching for the first warm day. There's always one that sneaks in during the middle of winter. Once we nail the bastard down, we go. Don't forget the goggles."
Finch. The first warm day. The second week of February, there's a blizzard that leaves the entire town without power for 2 days. The best thing about it is that school is canceled, but the worst thing is that the snow is so high and the air so bitter cold, you can barely stay out in it for more than 5 minutes at a time. I tell myself it's only water in a different form, and I walk all the way to Violet's, where we build the world's largest snowman. We name him Mr. Black and decide he'll be a destination for others to see when they're wandering. Afterward, we sit with her parents around the fire, and I pretend I'm part of the family. Once the roads are clear, Violet and I creep very, very carefully down them to see the painted rainbow bridge, the periodic table display, the seven pillars, and the lynching and burial site of the Reno brothers, America's first train robbers. We climb the sheer high walls of Empire Quarry, where they got the 18,630 tons of stone needed to build the Empire State Building. We visit the Indiana Moon Tree, which is a giant sycamore more than 30 years old that grew from a seed taken to the moon and brought back. This tree is nature's rock star, because it's one of only 50 left alive from an original set of 500. We go to Kokomo to hear the hum in the air, and we park Little Bastard in neutral at the base of Gravity Hill and roll to the top. It is like the world's slowest roller coaster, but somehow it works, and minutes later, we're at the peak. Afterward, I take her out for a Valentine's Day dinner at my favorite restaurant, Happy Family, which sits at the end of a strip mall about 15 miles from home. It serves the best Chinese food east of the Mississippi. The first warm day falls on a Saturday, which is how we end up in Prairieton at the Blue Hole, a 3-acre lake that sits on private property. I collect our offerings, the stubs of her SAT number 2 pencils, and 4 broken guitar strings. The air is so warm, we don't even need jackets, just sweaters, and after the winter we've been through so far, it feels almost tropical. I hold out my hand and lead her up the embankment and down the hill to a wide, round pool of blue water, ringed by trees. It's so private and silent that I pretend we're the only 2 people on Earth, which is how I wish it could be for real. "Okay," she says, letting out a long breath, as if she's been holding it all this time. The goggles hang around her neck. "What is this place?" "This," I say, "is the Blue Hole. They say it's bottomless, or that the bottom is quicksand. They say there's a force in the middle of the lake that sucks you down into an underground river that flows right into the Wabash. They say it leads you to another world. That it was a hiding place for pirates burying treasure,
and for Chicago bootleggers burying bodies and dumping stolen cars. That in the 1950s, a group of teenage boys went swimming here and disappeared. In 1969, two sheriff's deputies launched an expedition to explore the hole, but they didn't find any cars or treasure or bodies. They also didn't find the bottom. What they did find was a whirlpool that nearly sucked them down. I've ditched the red cap, gloves, and black sweater, and am wearing a navy pullover and jeans. I've cut my hair shorter, and when she first saw me, Violet said, "All-American, Finch." "Okay." Now I kick off my shoes and yank off the shirt. It's almost hot in the sun, and I want to go swimming. Bottomless blue holes exist all over the world, and each one has these kinds of myths associated with it. They were formed as caverns thousands of years ago during the last ice age. They're like black holes on Earth, places where nothing can escape, and time and space come to an end. How bloody awesome is it that we actually have one of our own? She glances back toward the house and the car and the road, then smiles up at me. Pretty awesome. She kicks off her shoes and pulls off her shirt and pants, so that, in seconds, she is standing there in only her bra and underwear, which are a kind of dull rose color, but somehow the sexiest things I've ever seen. I go totally and utterly speechless, and she starts to laugh. "Well, come on. I know you're not shy, so drop your pants and let's do this. I assume you want to see if the rumors are true." My mind draws a blank, and she juts one hip out, Amanda Monk style, resting a hand on it. "About it being bottomless?" "Oh, yeah. Right, of course." I slide off my jeans so I'm in my boxers, and I take her hand. We walk to the rock ledge that surrounds part of the hole and climb up onto it. "What are you most afraid of?" I say before we jump. I can already feel my skin starting to burn from the sun. "Dying? Losing my parents? Staying here for the rest of my life? Never figuring out what I'm supposed to do? Being ordinary? Losing everyone I love?" I wonder if I'm included in that group. She is bouncing on the balls of her feet, as if she's cold. I try not to stare at her chest as she does, because whatever else he is, All-American Finch is not a perv. "What about you?" she asks. She fits the goggles into place. "What are you most afraid of?" I think I'm most afraid of just be careful. I'm most afraid of the long drop. I'm most afraid of asleep and impending weightless doom. I'm most afraid of me. "I'm not." I take her hand, and together we leap through the air. And in that moment, there's nothing I fear except losing hold of her hand. The water is surprisingly warm and, below the surface, strangely clear and, well, blue. I look at her, hoping her eyes are open, and they are. With my free hand I point below, and she nods, her hair fanning out like seaweed. Together, we swim, still linked, like a person with three arms. We head down, where the bottom would be if there was one. The deeper we go, the darker the blue becomes. The water feels darker, too, as if the weight of it has settled. It's only when I feel her tug at my hand that I let myself be pulled back up to the surface, where we break out of the water and fill our lungs. "Jesus," she says, "you can hold your breath." "I practice," I say, suddenly wishing I hadn't said it at all, because it's one of those things, like I am make-believe, that sounds better in my own head. She just smiles and splashes me, and I splash her back. We do this for a while, and I chase her around the surface, ducking under, grabbing her legs. She slips through my grasp and breaks into a breaststroke, clean and strong. I remind myself that she's a California girl and probably grew up swimming in the ocean. I suddenly feel jealous of all the years she had before meeting me, and then I swim after her. We tread water, looking at each other, and suddenly there's not enough water in the world to clean away my dirty thoughts. She says, "I'm glad we came." We float on our backs, holding hands again, faces to the sun. Because my eyes are closed, I whisper, "Marco." "Polo," she answers, and her voice sounds lazy and far away. After a while, I say, "Do you want to go look for the bottom again?" "No, I like it here, just like this." Then she asks, "When did the divorce happen?" "Around this time last year." "Did you know it was coming?" "I did, and I didn't." "Do you like your stepmother?" "She's fine. She has a 7-year-old son, who may or may not be my dad's, because I'm pretty sure he was cheating with her for the past few years. He left us once, when I was 10 or 11, said he couldn't deal with us anymore. I think he was with her then. He came back, but when he left for good, he made it clear it was our fault. Our fault he came back. Our fault he had to leave. He just couldn't have a family. And then he married a woman with a kid. What's he like?" "The son I will never be. He's just a kid. I don't want to talk about Josh Raymond. I'm going in search of the bottom. Are you okay here? Do you mind?" "I'm good. You go. I'll be here." She floats away. I take a breath and dive, grateful for the dark of the water and the warmth against my skin. I swim to get away from Josh Raymond and my cheating father and Violet's involved parents, who are also her friends, and my sad, deserted mother, and my bones. I close my eyes and pretend it's Violet who surrounds me instead, and then I open my eyes and push myself down, one arm out like Superman. I feel the strain of my lungs wanting air, but I keep going. It feels a lot like the strain of trying to stay awake when I can feel the darkness sliding under my skin, trying to borrow my body without asking, so that my hands become its hands, my legs its legs. I dive deeper, lungs tight and burning. I feel a distant twinge of panic, but I make my mind go quiet before I send my body deeper. I want to see how far I can go. She's waiting for me. The thought fills me, but I can still feel the darkness working its way up, through my fingers, trying to grab hold. Less than 2% of people in the U.S. kill themselves by drowning, maybe because the human body was built to float. The number one country in the world for drowning, accidental or otherwise, is Russia, which has twice as many deaths as the next highest, Japan. The Cayman Islands, surrounded by the Caribbean Sea, has the fewest drownings of all. I like it deeper, where the water feels heaviest. Water is better than running because it blocks everything out. Water is my special power, my way to cheat the asleep and stop it from coming on. I want to go even deeper than this, because the deeper, the better. I want to keep going. But something makes me stop. The thought of Violet, the burning sensation in my lungs. I stare longingly at the black of where the bottom should be, but isn't. And then I stare up again at the light, very faint, but still there, waiting with violet, over my head. It takes strength to push myself up because I need air by now, badly. The panic comes back, stronger this time, and then I aim myself for the surface. Come on, I think. Please, come on. My body wants up, but it's tired. I'm sorry. I'm sorry, Violet. I won't leave you again. I don't know what I was thinking. I'm coming. When I finally hit the air, she is sitting on the bank, crying. Asshole, she says. I feel my smile go, and I swim toward her, head up, afraid to put it under again, even for a second, afraid she'll freak out. Asshole, she says, louder this time, standing, still in her underwear. She wraps her arms around herself, trying to get warm, trying to cover up, trying to pull away from me. What the hell? Do you know how scared I was? I searched everywhere. I went as deep as I could before I ran out of air and had to come back up like 3 times. I want her to say my name because then I'll know it's okay and I haven't gone too far and I haven't just lost her forever. But she doesn't. And I can feel a cold, dark feeling growing in the pit of my stomach. Every bit as cold and dark as the water. I find the outer edge of the blue hole where there's suddenly a bottom, and I rise up out of it until I'm next to her, dripping on the bank. She pushes me hard, and then again, so I go jolting backward, but I don't lose my footing. I stand there as she slaps at me, and then she starts to cry, and she is shaking. I want to kiss her, but I've never seen her like this. And I'm not sure what she'll do if I try to touch her. I tell myself, for once it's not about you, Finch. So I stand an arm's length away and say, let it out. All that stuff you're carrying around. You're pissed off at me, at your parents, at life, at Eleanor. Come on. Let me have it. Don't disappear in there. I mean, inside herself, where I'll never get to her. Screw you, Finch! Better. Keep going. Don't stop now. Don't be a waiting person. You lived. You survived a really horrible accident. But you're just there. You're just existing like everyone else. Get up! Do this, do that, lather, rinse, repeat, over and over so that you don't have to think about it. She shoves me again and again. Stop acting like you know how I feel! She's pounding at me with her fists, but I just stand, feet planted, and take it. I know there's more in there, probably years of shit you've been smiling away and keeping down. She pounds and pounds, and then suddenly covers her face. You don't know how it is. It's like I've got this angry little person inside me, and I can feel him trying to get out. He's running out of room because he's growing bigger and bigger, and so he starts rising up into my lungs, chest, throat, and I just push him right back down. I don't want him to come out. I can't let him out. Why not? Because I hate him. Because he's not me. But he's in there and he won't leave me alone and all I can think is that I want to go up to someone, anyone, and just knock them into space because I'm angry at all of them. So don't tell me. Break something. Smash something. Throw something. Or scream. Just get it out of you! I yell again. I yell and yell. Then I pick up a rock and smash it into the wall that surrounds the hole. I hand her a rock and she stands, palm up, like she's not sure what to do. I take the rock from her and hurl it against the wall, then hand her another. Now she's hurling them at the wall and shouting and stomping, and she looks like a crazy person. We jump up and down the banks and storm around smashing things, and then she turns on me all of a sudden and says, "What are we anyway? What exactly is going on here?" It's at that moment that I can't help myself, even though she is furious, even though she maybe hates me right now. I pull her in and kiss her the way I've always wanted to kiss her, a lot more R-rated than PG-13. I can feel her tense at first, not wanting to kiss me back, and the thought of it breaks my heart. Before I can pull away, I feel her bend and then melt into me, as I melt into her under the warm Indiana sun. And she's still here, and she isn't going anywhere, and it will be okay. I am carried off. We yield to this slow flood. In and out, we are swept. We cannot step outside its sinuous, its hesitating, its abrupt, its perfectly encircling walls. And then I push her away. "What the hell, Finch?" She is wet and angry and staring at me with large gray-green eyes. "You deserve better. I can't promise you I'll stay around. Not because I don't want to. It's hard to explain. I'm a fuck-up. I'm broken, and no one can fix it. I've tried. I'm still trying. I can't love anyone because it's not fair to anyone who loves me back. I'll never hurt you. Not like I want to hurt Romer, but I can't promise I won't pick you apart. Piece by piece, until you're in 1,000 pieces just like me. You should know what you're getting into before getting involved. In case you haven't noticed, we're already involved, Finch. And in case you haven't noticed, I'm broken too." Then she says, "Where did you get the scar? The real story this time." "The real story's boring. My dad gets in these black moods, like the blackest black, like no moon, no stars, storms coming black. I used to be a lot smaller than I am now. I used to not know how to get out of the way. These are just some of the things I never wanted to say to her. I wish I could promise you perfect days and sunshine, but I'm never going to be Ryan Cross. If there's one thing I know, it's that no one can promise anything. And I don't want Ryan Cross. Let me worry about what I want." And then she kisses me. It's the kind of kiss that makes me lose track of everything. And so it may be hours or minutes by the time we break apart. She says, "By the way, Ryan Cross is a kleptomaniac. He steals stuff for fun. And not even things he wants, but everything. His room looks like one of those rooms on Hoarders. Just in case you thought he was perfect. Ultraviolet remarkable. I think I love you." So that she doesn't feel she has to say it back, I kiss her again, and wonder if I dare do anything else, go any further, because I don't want to ruin this moment. And then, because I'm now the one thinking too much, and because she is different from all other girls, and because I really, really don't want to screw this up, I concentrate on kissing her on the banks of the blue hole, in the sunshine, and I let that be enough.
Violet. The day of. Around 3 o'clock, the air turns cool again, and we drive to his house to shower and get warm. His house is empty because everyone comes and goes as they please. He grabs waters from the fridge and a bag of pretzels, and I follow him upstairs, still damp and shivering. His bedroom is blue now. Walls, ceiling, floor, and all the furniture has been moved to one corner so that the room is divided in two. There's less clutter, no more wall of notes and words. All that blue makes me feel like I'm inside a swimming pool, like I'm back at the blue hole. I shower first, standing under the hot water, trying to get warm. When I come out of the bathroom, wrapped in a towel, Finch has music playing on the old turntable. Unlike his swim in the blue hole, his shower lasts no more than a minute. Before I'm dressed, he reappears, towel around his waist, and says,
"You never asked me what I was doing up on that ledge."
He stands, open and ready to tell me anything, but for some reason, I'm not sure I want to know. "What were you doing up on that ledge?" It comes out a whisper.
"The same thing you were. I wanted to see what it was like. I wanted to imagine jumping off it. I wanted to leave all the shit behind. But when I did start to imagine it, I didn't like what it looked like. And then I saw you."
He takes my hand and spins me out, and then in, so I'm tucked against him. And we sway and rock a little, but mostly stand still, pressed together, my heart pounding, because if I tilt my head back just like this, he will kiss me like he's doing now. I can feel his lips curving up at the corners, smiling. I open my eyes at the moment he opens his, and his blue, blue eyes are shining so fierce and bright that they're nearly black. The damp hair is falling across his forehead, and he rests his head against mine. And then I realize his towel is lying on the floor, and he's naked. I lay my fingers against his neck long enough to feel his pulse, which feels just like my own, racing and feverish.
"We don't have to."
"I know." And then I close my eyes as my own towel drops and the song comes to an end. I still hear it after we are in the bed and under the sheets and other songs are playing.
Finch. The day of. She is oxygen, carbon, hydrogen, nitrogen, calcium, and phosphorus. The same elements that are inside the rest of us. But I can't help thinking she's more than that, and she's got other elements going on that no one's ever heard of, ones that make her stand apart from everybody else. I feel this brief panic as I think, what would happen if one of those elements malfunctioned or just stopped working altogether? I make myself push this aside and concentrate on the feel of her skin until I no longer see molecules, but Violet. As the song plays on the turntable, I hear one of my own that's taking shape. "You make me love you." The line plays over and over in my head as we move from standing to lying down. "You make me love you. You make me love you. You make me love you." I want to get up and write it down and tack it to the wall, but I don't. Afterward, as we lie tangled up, kind of winded and, huh, and wow, she says, I should get home. We lie there a little longer, and then she says it again. I should get home. In the car, we hold hands and don't talk about what happened. Instead of driving to her house, I take a detour. When I get to the Purina Tower, she wants to know what we're doing. I grab the blanket and pillow from the back and say, I'm going to tell you a story. Up there? Yes. We climb up the steel ladder, all the way to the top. The air must be cold because I can see my breath, but I feel warm all the way through. We walk past the Christmas tree and I spread out the blanket. We lie down and wrap ourselves in, and then I kiss her. She is smiling as she pushes me away. So tell me this story. We lie back, her head on my shoulder, and, as if I ordered them, the stars are clear and bright. There are millions of them. I say, there was this famous British astronomer named Sir Patrick Moore. He hosted a BBC television program called Sky at Night, which ran for something like 55 years. Anyway, on April 1st, 1976, Sir Patrick Moore announced on his show that something extraordinary was getting ready to happen in the skies. At exactly 9:47 a.m., Pluto would pass directly behind Jupiter in relation to the Earth. This was a rare alignment that meant the combined gravitational force of those two planets would exert a stronger tidal pull, which would temporarily counteract gravity here on Earth and make people weigh less. He called this the Jovian-Plutonian gravitational effect. Violet is heavy against my arm, and for a minute I wonder if she's asleep. Patrick Moore told viewers that they could experience the phenomenon by jumping in the air at the exact moment the alignment occurred. If they did, they would feel weightless, like they were floating. She shifts a little. At 9:47 a.m., he told everyone, "Jump now!" Then he waited. 1 minute passed, and the BBC switchboard lit up with hundreds of people calling in to say they'd felt it. One woman phoned from Holland to say she and her husband had swum around the room together. A man called from Italy to say he and his friends had been seated at a table, and all of them, including the table, rose into the air. Another man called from the States to say he and his children had flown like kites in their backyard. Violet is propped up now, looking at me. Did those things actually happen? Of course not. It was an April Fool's joke. She smacks my arm and lies back down. You had me believing. But I bring it up to let you know that this is the way I feel right now. Like Pluto and Jupiter are aligned with the Earth. And I'm floating. In a minute, she says, You're so weird, Finch. But that's the nicest thing anyone's ever said to me.
Violet, the morning after. I wake up before him, and the blanket is cocooned over us like a tent. I lie there for a while, enjoying the feel of his arm around me and the sound of his breathing. He's so still and quiet, I barely recognize him. I watch the way his eyelids twitch as he dreams, and I wonder if he's dreaming of me. Like he can feel me watching, he opens his eyes. You're real, he says. That's me. Not a Jovian-Plutonian gravitational effect. No.
In that case,
he grins wickedly.
I hear that Pluto and Jupiter and the Earth are about to align. I wonder if you want to join me in a floating experiment.
He pulls me in closer and the blanket shifts. I blink into the brightness and the cold as it hits me. It's morning. As in, the sun is coming up. As in, the sun went down at some point and I never went home or called my parents to let them know where I was. As in, we are still on top of the Purina Tower where we have spent the night. It's morning, I say, and I feel like I'm going to be sick. Finch sits up, his face gone blank.
Shit.
Oh my God, oh my God, oh my God.
Shit, shit, shit.
It feels like years before we are down the 25,000 steps and back on the ground. I phone my parents as Finch tears out of the parking lot. Mom, it's me. At the other end of the line, she bursts into tears. And then my dad is on saying,
Are you okay? Are you safe?
Yes, yes, I'm sorry. I'm coming. I'm almost there. Finch breaks speed records to get me home, but he doesn't say a word to me, maybe because he's concentrating so hard on the driving. I don't say anything either until we turn the corner onto my street. It hits me all over again, this thing I've done. Oh my God, I say into my hands. Finch jerks to a stop, and we are out of the car and rushing up the walk. The door to the house is standing open, and I can hear voices inside rising and falling. You should go, I tell him. Let me talk to them. But at that moment, my dad appears, and he looks like he's aged 20 years overnight. His eyes run over my face, making sure I'm okay. He pulls me in and hugs me tight, almost strangling the breath out of me. Then he is saying over my head,
Go inside, Violet. Tell Finch goodbye.
It sounds final the way he says it, like, tell Finch goodbye because you will never see him again. Behind me, I hear Finch.
We lost track of time. It's not Violet's fault. It's mine. Please, don't blame her.
My mom is there now, and I say to my dad, It's not his fault. But my dad isn't listening. He's still looking over my head at Finch.
I'd get out of here if I were you, son.
When Finch doesn't move, my father pushes forward a little, and I have to block him. James! My mom tugs at my dad's arm so he can't go through me and after Finch. And then we are pushing my dad into the house. And now my mom is the one practically strangling me as she hugs me too tightly and cries into my hair. I can't see anything because once again I'm being smothered, and eventually I hear Finch drive away. Inside, after my parents and I have all, somewhat, calmed down, I sit, facing them. My dad does most of the talking as my mom stares at the floor, her hands resting limply on her knees.
The boy is troubled, Violet. The boy is unpredictable. He's dealt with anger issues since he was little. This is not the kind of person you need to be spending time with.
How did you? But then I remember the numbers Finch gave him, written so neatly, so carefully. Did you call his mother? My mom says.
What were we supposed to do?
My dad shakes his head.
He lied to us about his father. The parents divorced last year. Finch sees him once a week.
I am trying to remember what Finch said about lies not being lies if they feel true. My mother says,
She called his father.
Who called?
Mrs. Finch. She said he would know what to do, that maybe he would know where Finch was.
My brain is trying to keep up with everything, to put out fires, to think of ways to tell my parents that Finch is not this lying, deceitful boy they seem to think he is, that in itself is a lie. But then my dad says,
"Why didn't you tell us he was the one in the bell tower?"
How did his dad tell you that, too? Maybe I don't have a right to, but my face is going hot, and my palms are burning the way they do when I get angry.
"When you weren't home by 1 a.m. and you didn't answer your phone, we called Amanda to see if you were at her house, or if she'd seen you. She said you were probably with Finch, the boy whose life you saved."
Mom's face is wet, her eyes red.
"Violet, we're not trying to be the bad guys here. We're just trying to do what's best."
"Best for who?" I want to say. "You don't trust me."
"You know better than that."
She looks hurt and also angry.
"We think we've been pretty damn cool, all things considered. But you need to take a minute to understand where we're coming from. We're not being overprotective, and we're not trying to suffocate you. We're trying to make sure you're okay.
And that nothing happens to me like it did to Eleanor. Why don't you just keep me locked up in the house forever so you never have to worry again?" Mom shakes her head at me. My father repeats,
"No more seeing him. No more of this driving around. I'll speak to your teacher on Monday if I need to. You can write a report or do something else to make up for the work. Are we understood?"
Extenuating circumstances. Here I am again.
"Excuse me?"
"Yes, we're understood." From my bedroom window, I watch the street outside, as if Finch might reappear. If he does, I will climb out of my window and tell him to drive, just drive, as fast and far as he can. I sit there a long time, and he doesn't come. My parents' voices rumble from the first floor, and I know that they will never trust me again.
Finch. What follows? I see his SUV before I see him. I almost drive on past my house and just keep going who knows where, but something makes me stop the car and walk on in. "I'm here," I yell. "Come and get me." My dad barrels out of the living room like a battering ram, Mom and Rose Marie fluttering behind him. My mom is apologizing to me or to him. It's hard to tell. What was I supposed to do? The phone rings at 2 a.m. There must be some emergency. Kate wasn't home. I didn't have a choice. My father doesn't say a word to me. Just sends me flying across the kitchen and into the door. I stand up, shake it off, and the next time he raises his arm, I laugh. This throws him so much that the arm stops in midair, and I can see him thinking he's crazier than I thought he was. I say, "Here's the thing. You can spend the next 5 hours or 5 days beating me to dust, but I don't feel it. Not anymore." I let him try to get in one last whack, but as his hand moves toward me, I grab it by the wrist. "Just so you know, you will never do that again." I don't expect it to work, but there must be something in my voice because he suddenly drops his arm. I say to Mom, "Sorry we worried everyone. Violet's home and she's safe, and I'm going to my room." I wait for my father to come after me. Instead of locking the door and pushing the dresser in front of it, I leave it open. I wait for my mother to check on me, but no one comes, because in the end, this is my house, which means you don't go out of your way to engage. I write Violet an apology. "I hope you're okay. I hope they're not too hard on you. I wish that hadn't happened,
but I don't regret anything that came before. She writes back, I'm okay. Are you okay? Did you see your dad?